From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nyland McBain says this debate among Mormons about whether women have an equal role in their church is not new. In her book, she says, from the earliest days of church history, relationships between men and women permeated discussions about doctrine and governance and practice. Think of the remarkable amount of autonomy early Mormon women had. They participated in healings and blessings. And for some reason over time, that was all phased out. McBain says gender relations are the very soil the church grew from. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about her book, which she sees as a pragmatic approach. Women, she says, are not going to get the priesthood in the foreseeable future. But she believes there's still a way to improve their role in Mormonism. Her book is called Women at Church. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may have heard Nyland McBain on this program before, and so you know that in the current debate over whether women should be ordained to the LDS priesthood, she finds herself somewhere in the middle. She wasn't crazy about some of the tactics used by the group Ordain Women, and she said so, thought they may have been, some of them anyway, counterproductive. But she's also said that there are equality problems within Mormonism and that some women, not all women, of course, but some women do feel pain over this. McBain is a realist, and for now, the reality she's working with as an active, engaged Mormon woman is that the current doctrine of excluding women from the LDS priesthood is not going to change, not for quite some time, if at all. And so what do women do about that? Because McBain has talked to lots of women and lots of men, too, and she believes that within the boundaries of the church, there is some wiggle room to move women forward. But it's going to take some creativity, she says, some imagination, some experimentation. She's written a book to make her case, and today in the program, she's joining us, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called Women at Church, Magnifying LDS Women's Local Impact. Nyland McBain is a blogger. She's a columnist, a founder, and editor-in-chief of the Mormon Women Project. It's an online library of interviews, conversations with LDS women from around the world. And she's joining us here in the studio. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me get a few things out of the way here first, this sort of disclaimer. So I noticed the book was being sold at Deseret Book, which means that on some level it had to have been approved by someone in authority within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Did you have to make any changes to get the church to sign off?
No, not at all. I mean, it's important to note that the book is not published by Deseret Book, which, of course, sort of exempts it from many of the Deseret Book criteria.
But they're selling
it. They are selling it, yes.
And that's a big deal. Did that surprise you, by the way?
No, I wasn't surprised, but I do think it speaks to the relationship that my publisher has with Deseret Book, which I appreciate. And, you know, I think that the demand for the book at the Deseret Book stores, I know, has been surprising to them, pleasantly surprising to all of us. So I've been very grateful for the shelf space that they've given to it.
So you didn't have to make any editorial changes based on concerns of people within the church itself?
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. No. And, you know, I don't know that I would have if we had gone to Deseret Book and asked them to sell it and they said no, but, you know, on the condition of changes, I wouldn't have done that. I think, you know, I think there's a vibrant publishing community outside of Deseret Book, which, of course, with the advent of other online distribution methods, makes it possible.
But you like the idea that mainstream Mormons
absolutely
are going
to have access
to it. Absolutely.
It was imprimatur, as one friend suggested, that it had been approved to some degree. And it is, of course, not an official text by any means, and it doesn't have an official endorsement. But that probably is as close as we get in the church. And I do recognize the value of that and appreciate it.
One point that you make pretty clear very early on in the book is that your book does not deal with doctrine. But I have to ask, and let me ask it this way. So during the, you know, decades-long debate over whether black men should be kept from the LDS priesthood, there was always this question, was the position of the church at the time doctrine or was it policy? In other words, if it were doctrine, did it come directly from God? And was it supported scripturally? Or was this just men, fallible men who had good intentions but kind of misread God? I'm wondering if you think the same kind of question might be at play here for the role of women in the priesthood. That is it God's idea to keep women out of significant leadership positions or limit their autonomy or not give them the priesthood? Or is that a policy that you think maybe one day could change? That's a very long question.
I mean, and there's a lot in there. There's the distinction between doctrine and culture, which I think we are becoming comfortable with as a people, as a subject of conversation. We do parse that out in our own ways in so many conversations. One of the reasons I think it is difficult to parse out is because the definition of doctrine in a non-canonical religion, such as our own, is non-creedal religion, excuse me, is that doctrine does differ for each individual depending on how they've been raised in the church and their perception of how sort of symbolic practices and social learning supports the principles that that they've, you know, been taught in church contexts. And so for me, as someone who grew up outside of Utah, I have a very distinct idea of how I parse out doctrine and culture. But I think since living here in Utah for the past 5 years, I can see how those two can become muddled. Rather than trying to define what doctrine is, I think it is
But why not just – that's a very complicated answer to that question. What is it, church doctrine that women can't hold the priesthood?
Oh, specifically about that. I mean, I do believe, and I think that it is foundational to what I write in the book, that there is a divinely mandated reason and a divine approbation for
the way things are now.
For the way things are now. At a very high level. I do not mean by any means that the way, you know, we practice our religion or the way Sunday worship is playing out on every stage every Sunday is divinely approved. I don't mean that. I mean the general structure. It takes more hubris than I am comfortable admitting to say that something's wrong with that. I feel much more comfortable, and I feel like you know, I feel comfortable expressing sort of the mystery and the unknowability of God in this particular conversation, because God's ways are not our ways. And there may be a wisdom and a reason for this.
For God withholding the priesthood from women. And you're cool with that right now, at least for now.
I'm cool with that, yes. Yeah. Yes.
You say in the book also that you're not interested in it becoming a platform for debates about the nature and the administration of the priesthood. But then you also said later in the book that you did want it to be part of an ongoing dialogue. How do you have it both ways? You don't want this to be cited in the debate, but you do want it to be a dialogue. I guess you can have it both ways in that sense, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what I try and do in the book is you know, start from this foundation that the structure we have now has goodness in it. There are kinks that need to be worked out, but there is an eternal truth that is at the heart of it. And so the approach is a very practical one to say, okay, what do we do with that? And the reason that we have to ask that question, what do we do with that, is because Mormon women today are living in a time and place, American Mormon women today are living in a time and place where we need to integrate with a larger culture that is very distinct and divergent from our own. You know, I talk about in the
wait,
beginning
so,
of the book.
So what you mean is, because I actually want to break this down.
Specifically in regards to gender relations.
Well, yeah. Right. So in other words, American culture, and you do, you sort of target American culture here,
mm-hmm.
because
yes.
it's another conversation when you get – but let's stick with that. American culture and Mormons in America, the experience that women have – they're not there yet, but there's certainly a level of equality that's – it's extraordinary and worth noting in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
That same experience is not happening within Mormonism.
Well,
fair to say?
I think I like to talk about it more in a more nuanced tone, terms about the ideal of a parity, the ideal of equality, right? The ideal of equal opportunities for men and women to aspire to the same organizational or levels of responsibility in our schools, in our governments, in our corporations. That is an American ideal, that men and women should be able to aspire to those similar positions of responsibility, because responsibility is perceived in those organizations as a reward, right? As a reward for aptitude, as a reward for past performance. And that same structure doesn't exist in the church today. That's simply a fact, right? And so you have situations in the church that are exemplified by Sam Gordon. And this is an example that some Utahns may know. But when I talk about the cognitive disconnect that some Mormon women, American Mormon women, are feeling today, I love going to this example of Sam Gordon. Sam Gordon is a football sensation. So the 11-year-old has been on the cover of a Wheaties box, being featured on Good Morning America, a Super Bowl commercial. There's Sam's autobiography written with the help of a ghostwriter, Sam's YouTube channel, and the fact that Sam recently spoke at a press conference with the governor of Utah. So why all this attention for an 11-year-old football phenom? Well, Sam Gordon is a girl. And not only is Sam Gordon a girl, Sam Gordon is a Mormon girl. And the ghostwriter of her autobiography was her home teacher. So here you have, on the one hand, a Mormon girl here locally in our community who is receiving the highest accolades that any child can receive, 11-year-old child can receive, because she is because she's breaking into boys' territory, you know. And so we have to ask ourselves that, you know, why do we respond as Americans, as Utahns, as Mormon Utahns, with such praise and adoration and sort of support for this girl who's doing something out in the world that within our church culture would be would really be frowned upon?
Yeah.
And that creates you know, I talk a lot about in the book about pain, but I want to define that pain as cognitive dissonance. It's not the pain of knowing that you're never going to see your spouse again after they die, or it's not the pain of wondering if you're ever going to be forgiven for a sin. It's cognitive dissonance. It's the dissonance that comes from living in two cultures, two worlds at one time, and seeing goodness in both, and wanting to strengthen each because you love each.
There is this. You have an interesting personal story that I think is worth mentioning. You were born and raised in New York City. Your mother is this acclaimed opera singer. She was with the Met. Your father converted to Mormonism, although he didn't stay terribly active, but he was pretty supportive. I mean, you went to some really good schools. And you hung out with some pretty sophisticated people in Manhattan. You lived, fairly close to the Met.
Across the street.
Across the street from the Met. So what was your experience like as a Mormon woman in your, Manhattan ward, I guess it would be, compared to the experience that some may have in, let's target Utah, in Sandy or in Centerville or Orem, for example, do you think?
I think, you know, the upbringing that you just described is one reason why I'm absolutely fascinated by this parsing of principles and practices. Because I had many different cultural influences growing up. I had the cultural influence of, you know, the church in New York in the 80s and 90s, which was exotic at that time. Now Manhattan's kind of like, you know, Provo East. Everyone kind of goes through New York at some point. But in the 80s and 90s, there were really two or three wards. We had one building, the Lincoln Center building, which was also very close to my home. And you really had to no Mormon just ended up in New York. You really had to go there. And so it was a remarkable place and introduced me to some remarkable people, men and women. But I also had the influence of a private girls' school. So I went to girls' school for 13 years. So I had 27 girls in my graduating class. And so that was a powerful influence as well. And I loved and I was often taught to appreciate the sort of protected space that I was being given to develop my voice as a woman, as a girl. And certainly there were some overtones of sort of feminist political agenda. But it was mostly in the sense of sort of, you know, if you imagine the shoulder padded woman of the 80s going off to Wall Street, it was sort of that kind of empowerment as opposed to more in contrast to perhaps belligerent conversations and conversations about power grabbing. They were a little bit more about, you know, in typical New York style, about making a lot of money as a woman. And so I had that, but because those two worlds coexisted, it helped put into light what each lacked.
Yeah. So you had role models within your ward of powerful women, mm-hmm. who were succeeding, were making their way up the corporate structure, even though it may have been difficult then, not mm-hmm. as difficult now, maybe. But they also were faithful.
They were.
They also were maybe discontent with some of the practices, but in general, they were okay.
I don't remember any of a conversation at that time about being discontent with practices, because there was a sense of – there was this incredible sense of autonomy and not ambitiousness, but just a go get it done sort of feeling. I mean, you know, I was grateful to be raised in the ward with Claudia Bushman, who talks very fondly and rightly so about the incredible projects that she just takes on, cultural projects and historical projects that she has spearheaded. And those are the kinds of things that I saw done. And there was a sense of true ownership of our membership in the church, you know, this being the church not only of Jesus Christ, but of Latter-day Saints, of us as a people. But then going back to the other cultural influence, I noticed very astutely that at my school, there was almost no conversation about motherhood or about our feminine identity in a family, or what that meant to us as an eternal identity, not in a spiritual sense, but just like as identity as women. The feminist conversations at school were always about money and politics. They weren't about my identity as a woman, and so I felt like it was a good balance between the two.
So I want to see if I can distill this down, because I want to break down the book as we go and get to as many points as we can, because there's some really important ones that I want to talk to you about. So we'll work through the details, but see if I have this about right. Some Mormon women, and that's important, some Mormon women are very content with their role in the LDS Church right now. But some women are in pain, your word, which you qualified back there, but that's okay.
Yeah.
In pain because they don't believe their role is equal to men. They believe their historical position in the church has been diminished over time. And it doesn't make much pragmatic sense to go to the sort of ordain women route, because that just creates hostility and maybe defensiveness. And so the solution for women, at least at the way you're thinking about it, is to be kind of content for now that things aren't really going to change. There's not going to be any great doctrinal transformation regarding the role of women right now. But that women can take heart that the church is gradually changing, and that there's enough flexibility and that there are enough openings in the structure of the church for men and women to be imaginative and creative about including women in more important roles within the church. That's another long summation there. Is it about right, what you're getting at?
I want to be clear. I want change. I will never approve a summary that says I'm happy with the way things are. I want a very different kind of change than creating a playing field where men and women's keys and authority are the same. I want change that allows the power that women have, the priesthood power that women have, the power of faith that they have to act in God's name, the power of the priesthood to act in God's name and to do good works and to build communities and to succor each other and to be responsible for both the spiritual and temporal welfare of each other. I want that to change so that it is a real force in the cultural lives of our men and women today in the church. I do not believe that we are there. I believe historically we've been closer, certainly in the 19th century, but I'm also quick to mention that in the early 20th century we had important structural mechanisms in place that allowed for the fostering and the growth and the development of that women's sphere, namely the Relief Society boards wrote the manuals for our Relief Society lessons. They were written by women, for women, about women, with women's quotes, women's stories.
Yeah, you had a magazine.
We had a magazine. We had granaries. We had cooperative stores. We had hospitals. We had education programs. You know, the list goes on. And I've, you know, I'm not a historian, but I've certainly done a lot of research over the past 5 years. And the more I learn, the more I have an appreciation for the political, social, cultural, temporal programs that our foremothers not just participated in, but ran and oversaw and commanded.
They were in charge.
They
had been given the – that sort of – and this is one of the elements that you say why I think some women might be in pain. There's not a greater awareness of history. And there's some big questions here. Has the official church departed from that earlier exclusion, you know, in the 19th century? And then it seems like there's been this cycle. So Joseph Smith, tell me if I get this right. Joseph Smith has a kind of extraordinary, innovative vision for women in that he says, and you point out in the book something that you found very inspiring, these minutes from this meeting where he establishes the Relief Society for Women, this women's organization in 1842. And he basically, I don't know, you found something really extraordinary there because he basically said, I'm giving you the keys. Now, keys is a big word for Mormons. Mm-hmm. It means the authority, right, to do your own thing. And he established a kind of precedent, and that's important. Would you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, Ordained Women has used that as an example of pointing to the fact that Joseph Smith probably didn't finish his work with the Relief Society, that he was killed before he could fully explain what that meant. And so they, of course, interpret that, to support their particular position.
That he was at some point going to ordain women.
Yes.
Right? But that's not what you're saying. What you're saying is whether or not he ordained women, that's irrelevant, at least for now. The point is he gave them an amazing amount of autonomy, right?
He gave them authority. And
authority, not in terms of
the authority to oversee priesthood ordinances, but the authority in the terms of the expectation that they would have influence. And that's the most important thing that I would love to see this conversation about women in the church foster is the awareness that women in the church today suffer from a lack of authority in the sense that they themselves do not perceive their voice to have influence and expect their voice to have influence, and there aren't the mechanisms in place for their voice to have influence. That's very different than letting them officiate in priesthood ordinances.
Yeah.
Right.
But don't you also make the point that while they may not have technically officiated, they did some blessings. They did some baby blessings. They did some healings. I mean, they were actually doing the real work.
Yes. And And, you know, I think one thing that we need to understand better as a people, and one thing that I fully admit that I don't understand completely, is, you know, what is the difference between a priesthood blessing and a healing and a faith and a heartfelt prayer of a mother? The answer lies in the distinction, the parsing out of priesthood into keys, authority, and power. But that is the distinction between keys, authority, and power is a conversation that people like Elder Dallin Oaks and Sherry Dew are just starting to lead us through recent talks and books. And I think that's an incredibly important conversation. But I think we're still in our infancy of understanding exactly what that's all about.
Mormon women today, though, cannot do healings, cannot do blessings.
No.
I guess this is a big question, but do you think you have an answer as to why did that get phased out? What happened to that? I mean, that's a big question hanging out there. You don't really resolve it, but you do raise it.
I do. And, you know, one of the things that I try and point out in the book is that many of the good things that allowed the church to grow in the 20th century are exactly the same things that we are now needing to course correct a little bit. And, you know, correlation, of course, always comes up when you're talking about
– what does that mean, correlation?
Correlation was the movement in the middle of the 20th century to streamline the manuals and all of the teaching materials and the teaching materials and the media materials that the church put out and
tidy everything up,
tidy
get everyone
up
on the same page, basically.
And, you know, I think correlation made the global expansion of the church possible. It really opened the doors to that, the explosion of the second half of the 20th century.
So there's the good part.
The good part.
But then it also
took away the budgets, yeah, that the Relief Society, autonomous budgets that the Relief Societies had you know, ownership and authority over. It took away those protected spaces in our magazine and our manuals that I referred to earlier. Another example is the introduction of the Teachings of the Prophets series that we've been studying in Relief Society and Priesthood for the past 17 years. You know, President Hinckley wanted a doctrinal book in every member's home. I mean, obviously a prophetic inspired decision, and one, again, that supported the global expansion of the church in immeasurable ways. What we're sort of opening our eyes to now is that for the last 17 years, there has not been a woman quoted or talked about in our Relief Society or priesthood meetings for 17 years.
And, you know, you tell this other story. I've heard you talk about this anyway, this woman who was a Relief Society president. This was in the 20th century, I think. Emmeline Wells?
Yes.
Now, I didn't realize this, but her office was right next to the president of the church or on the same floor?
Church administration building, yeah.
And then as soon as all this stuff changed, they got her out of the administration building.
That happened very early in the century. That was in the first decade of the century when the bishop.
But wasn't that a significant marker?
She understood that was very symbolic, and that was very significant to her.
Which meant what? That I know we gave you guys autonomy before, but we're changing the program.
I mean, I think I can. You know, I don't know. I haven't read personal accounts of her response to that, but I can imagine that, you know, having your office across the hall from President Smith sort of was a symbolic representation of your standing to, as Joseph Smith says and Brigham Young says when he reorganizes the Relief Society in Utah, to act as the first presidency. And when she was moved to the bishop's building, where the presiding bishopric was to be then housed, I can't help but think that was an incredibly symbolic move for her. And
a step down.
And Emmeline Wells was really the president of the Relief Society who, I mean, she was the editor of the Exponent. She was involved in the suffrage movement. She was president for a long time, and she was the first Relief Society president to be released before her death. So there was also that precedent, and she actually died 2 weeks later, some say of a broken heart. So there were a lot of changes, and that was the first decade of the 20th century. So we do see, even as early as that, even before correlation in the 1960s, some of these changes taking place.
I want to get to the solutions that you're proposing and some of these innovations or some of this imaginative use of the scaffolding of Mormonism when we get back from a break. But let me ask you something before, because I was supposed to do a break like 10 minutes ago. But there is something you write about, this so-called disconnect between doctrine and practice of equality. And I wanted to ask you about this because this seems like another important thing, the question of what do we mean by equality? You come right out and you say Mormons do themselves a disservice by continually asserting that men and women are equal.
In the eyes of the world,
in the eyes of the world. And you come right out and say, we're not. We're just not.
If you are using the measuring stick that, as I referred to earlier, our schools, our institutions, our governments, our corporations are using, which is by definition an ideal scenario in which men and women can aspire to the same positions of influence.
But what's the difference? Why is God's administration of a church different from the world? I mean, I guess for religious people, there's an obvious answer to that. It's God. But why would it be different? Because you frame the question this way in the book. You say, if we believe in equality, do we have an obligation to practice equality? And if we practice equality, what does that look like? Because you say the challenge for women is to separate the equation and believe in equality without practicing it in the same way to which we're accustomed.
I think it looks different in the church.
Why? Why would that be different? Why would it be different? Why would God want it to be different?
Well,
do you think you know?
I don't think I know.
Yeah.
I think that when I read the teachings of the Savior, he asks us to do hard things. He asks us to create structures and build kingdoms that have not existed in any other form in the outside world. And I was reminded of this when I went to Manti recently for the first time. We were driving down to southern Utah through Manti, actually on Thanksgiving Day, which is a long story. But, we entered this enormous barren valley, and it was a cold November day. And even in the distance, probably from, 20 minutes away, we could see this beacon on this little peninsula off of a mountain jutting out into the valley. And it was so awe-inspiring for me to be there and to
see the
Manti
Temple. Of course.
This beacon on the hill there. And I was so moved by the idea of our people doing hard things and our people building things, literally physical structures as well as administrative structures and kingdom structures that perhaps the world has not seen before. And I was moved and touched by the ambition of our people. And I think perhaps we've lost sight of that a little bit in our conversations about women. How can we take the best of what the world is offering but pairing it with our own sense of divine mandate and our own trust?
So this is what a Mormon equality looks like? Because that is a question you ask in the book, or refer to anyway, that equality – here's what you say. You say, how can equal not mean 50-50? I mean, for a lot of Mormon women, they're like, no, that's not good enough. If I'm going to be equal, I'm going to have access to the same keys and all that kind of stuff. And you're saying, okay, but it's different with Mormonism. At least if I get what you're saying, it's different because it's not mathematical absolutism is how you put it in the book. There's a different equation. So Mormon equality looks different. And the way it looks, the part that you're cool with right now anyway, is that men do the priesthood stuff. We have to come up with other interesting, creative ways for men to do that, right?
Yes. And women have been tasked with the spiritual nurturing, and I think that needs to be expanded and given more bulk and depth.
Which we'll get to right after a break. Nylan McBain is with us. Her book is Women at Church, Magnifying LDS Women's Local Impact. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Nylan McBain is joining us. She's a blogger, a columnist, founder, and editor-in-chief of the Mormon Women Project. It's an online library of interviews with LDS women from around the world. She's written a book called Women at Church, and we're talking about it. So I wanted to ask you about this idea of – you point out that the world has really changed for women, and it's really changed fast. But you also explain that most of the church's apostles and members of the First Presidency grew up in a certain gender culture, I guess, which is just sort of your way of saying they grew up – they're men of a generation. You know, the 50s, you know, where women wore dresses all the time and had, you know, dinner ready when the men walked in. So you're saying they're men of this generation, I suppose. You're asking for a little bit of empathy from people to say, let's take into account where they came from and empathize with the fact that they're trying to make sense of all of this change because it's coming at them. I mean, these are older guys.
Yeah.
And it's coming at them really fast. So you so part of you really empathizes with that, and you're saying,
absolutely,
let's give them a little bit of a break.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
But I want to play this this clip, and I wanted to get your reaction to it because church, it seems like church leaders hate the idea that people say they're out of touch. Don't seem to like it at all. There's a clip from Jeffrey Holland from This Was General Conference in 2006. You know it?
Yes.
Let me play it because I want to get you to react to it.
Not often, but over the years, some sources have suggested that the brethren are out of touch in their declarations, that they don't know the issues, that some of their policies and practices are out of date, not relevant to our times. As the least of those who have been sustained by you to witness the guidance of this church firsthand, I say with all the fervor of my soul that never in my personal or professional life have I ever associated with any group who are so in touch, who know so profoundly the issues facing us, who look so deeply into the old, stay so open to the new, and weigh so carefully, thoughtfully, and prayerfully everything in between.
He's really passionate about
he
this
is.
Point. Now, I don't want to put you at odds with Elder Holland. That would make you feel uncomfortable.
And I don't think there's any need to.
But you are saying they're men of a certain generation. What's wrong with saying they're a little out of touch? So what? They're old guys. A lot of them are really old people.
I think saying that there is something of a cultural inertia because positive formative experiences happened within a certain gender culture and we need to be sensitive to that is very different than
but
saying
doesn't
that
this send
out of
a
touch.
Mixed message?
I don't think I would ever say that they're out of touch. I think that
that is what you're saying, isn't it? Aren't you saying they're out of touch?
Mm-hmm.
And that we should empathize with the fact that they're out of touch? They're men who grew up, a lot of them, in the 50s and the 60s. And so let's empathize. They
no,
had a certain
I'm saying
gender
that they,
culture.
That they found positive cultural formative principles in the experiences of that era.
But Nylan, don't you think it would be easier for you to get to work within the boundaries if everyone could concede and that there wouldn't be anything wrong with saying within the structures of Mormonism that older leaders maybe should talk to younger women and get a sense of what the kids are saying these days.
But
and
they
how
do.
It's, and you say they do.
They do.
So I don't understand what you mean then in this. I don't understand what you mean then.
I think
– it seems like you're saying on one hand they're men of a generation.
Let's take it away. Let's step away for a second from the conversation about individual men. The point that I think leads up to that statement in the book is a discussion of the fact that in 1962, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was chosen to represent the United States, the cultural output of the United States, and sing in front of Mount Rushmore and have the broadcast sent up in a space capsule, in a time capsule, in a spaceship. I mean, can you imagine today the Tabernacle Choir being selected from all of American cultural output as the representative artistic contribution. And so what I'm saying there is that culturally, as the church in the lifetime of a large number of our membership, we've moved from being completely aligned with mainstream Mormon culture, as we were in 1962.
American culture.
American culture, excuse me. To being very – almost back to a place that we were almost as dramatically as we were in the 19th century, being outside of that mainstream culture. And that is the trajectory that I'm talking about. I don't think – I mean it was certainly never intended to be any sort of personal indictment against anybody individually. But the idea that culturally as a people, what worked for us and what made us embraced by mainstream American culture in the 1960s – has put us at odds with them now.
Right.
And there's going to be a tension among the 12, among the 70, among all members who remember that time frame, among my own parents, you know, right. that disconnect is going to pull at us. And we're going – you know, those people understandably are going to look back and say, you know, what's happening? Because we were doing things a certain way and it was working and we were – aligned, and we saw goodness in those practices, right? So I think what I'm saying is the impetus to abandon those may need a little bit greater of a catalyst, a greater push than it would for some of us that don't remember that time and look back on it as quaint.
Right. Let's move on to some of the solutions you propose in the book, because you point out there's no silver bullet here to address the concerns and some of the contradictions that some women may encounter within their experience, their lived experience in Mormonism. You describe the book, though, as a strategic approach, a framework to affect change. You even call it a tool. So I want to talk about the handbook. And for the uninitiated, for people who aren't Mormon, explain what the handbook is. This is kind of the rule book, right?
Yeah, there are two of them, actually. Handbook one is something that is –
There are two handbooks?
Yes. Huh? The handbook one is something that's in print and accessible to sort of stake – I mean to priesthood leaders, congregational leaders, and above. And Handbook 2 is the book that's accessible by all membership and is available online. And I worked exclusively with Handbook 2 as I thought a proxy for orthodoxy. And I also worked exclusively with Handbook 2 because I wanted to work only among the materials that the average member has access to, both in knowledge and in, you know, areas of
administration. So the handbook says women – cannot be ordained, obviously. Mm-hmm. Women cannot lead administrative positions in local wards and branches.
Well, I mean, it doesn't, you know.
It doesn't?
That sentence doesn't exist.
Okay, no, of course.
Through omission.
But the essence of that, right,
yes.
Is it's somewhat limiting. And what you're – but it does say this. Local leaders are free to adapt some church programs. And you see that as your way in? Is this kind of your loophole?
I don't think it's a loophole at all. I think it is
it's an opportunity.
It's a mandate from the beginning of the church that the membership should not and need not wait in sort of a stance of blind obedience. For every command, we are commanded to.
We work. Have flexibility in this document. Let's use it. Is that what you're
Absolutely.
Saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a whole section there on adaptability, and I think that tends to get overlooked. You know, we are an obedient people as we should be, but there's an equal and opposite force to that obedience, which is agency, and it's equally important and equally eternal in its saving, its ability to save. And I think. Working out the tension between those two is kind of at the heart of this whole conversation.
I've heard you in an interview. This was a podcast somewhere where you said, as far as the handbook is concerned, you have to learn to read between the lines. That the church is this flexible living organism that's built for the members. So how much wiggle room do you have in that document, in this adaptation idea? And tell me specifically, what does that mean for Mormon women in terms of how their lives may change, how their role in wards and in branches and in stakes may be transformed, how we can be, Mormon women would say, could be more creative?
Well, when I say you read between the lines of the handbook, I don't mean that in any subversive way.
I didn't think you did.
I think you simply
can't
have
a— But you are seeing
global,
that as an opportunity.
Absolutely.
Like, let's take this. They're giving us some flexibility. Let's grab it.
Yes. So, you know, the parallel I like to draw is that rather than looking at the handbook and saying, well, it's not in the handbook, so I can't do it, let's read the handbook in a new way, which is, well, the handbook doesn't say I can't, so I'm going to try it for the benefit of my people that I have stewardship over. And I think, you know, I'll share a quick story from my ward a few weeks ago that I think illustrates in a broad stroke the kind of approach that I'm taking. So a few weeks ago in my ward, we had the Elders' Quorum and Relief Society lesson from the teachings of the Presidents of the Church, Joseph Fielding Smith manual, and it was called The Work of Latter-day Saint Women. And I think, you know, most wards had this lesson towards the end of the year. And in my ward, the Elders' Quorum teacher, who I do not know, and he doesn't know me, you know, he led the class through each one of the squares in Patriarchy Bingo, which is the Ordained Women product that they've posted online in – they've called it an icebreaker activity produced by Ordained Women to help identify some symptoms of growing up in a patriarchal culture. That's the way they describe it. And they published it on their website. And I thought it was so fascinating that the men in my, you know, mainstream conservative middle of the valley Utah ward would have not far from a controversial or heated discussion. It was actually an eye-opening discussion for them. And they came up to me afterwards, those who know me and know my work, and they wanted to tell me that in— My home teacher summarized it later in the day. He said, we realized that only one of the symptoms in the game was a direct result of women not having priesthood authority. The rest are things we can control with what we have today. And you know, the examples—
So that confirmed your idea that, yeah, there is some move for movement.
Yeah. You know, the examples he was looking at were things like the leaders you grew up learning about, singing about, and honoring were men. This is something I feel passionate about. This is not an issue of priesthood ordination. In my mind, my, you know, sisters at Ordained Women may say that you know, these symptoms happen because there is no female ordination. I see these as things that, you know, we have in our power to change the way that we talk about women and represent women and quote from women and share women's stories in our lessons at church. That doesn't require priesthood and ordination. If you looked for spiritual guidance, it was usually from a man. That was another example. Again, you know, We can do something about that. You were taught that your primary goal in life was temple marriage, while boys were also taught to prepare for a career. I've talked in other places about this idea of shifting the conversation around women's vocations and purposes and responsibility to a both-and model. Like, you can have the temple marriage, the motherhood, and you need to think about how to magnify your potential in a academic, industrial way as well, rather than the either-or model, which is more common in our narratives. And the one that they did say couldn't be changed was, of course, your brothers were able to perform ordinances when they turned 12. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Absolutely true. But the point is that, you know, when you go through an exercise like that, my conclusion is it's a process. It's a journey. It's a long term.
You're not as concerned with the end point as this.
I'm not concerned as much with the end point as the idea of increasing the visibility, the authoritative voice, the inclusion of women in narratives and lessons, all of that in our lived experience, both in the worship setting and in our home, family, and social settings.
You know, this question has come and I've neglected most of your questions. Forgive me, listeners. One question is, where do you see Mormon feminism going in 10 years from now? Which I think is a good question, and let me just sort of expand it a bit. Like, in 15, in 20 years, where do you see the church being in regards to its relationship with women? And because here's something you write in the book. You say, I'm convinced we can ease adverse symptoms to a point where we move women, where more women can be at peace with our current structure as we look to continued prophetic guidance. Now that, to me, says I'm looking to prophetic guidance. I'm looking that there may be a chance that things may shift in the big way, but also in this, in these other ways as well. Is that right?
Continuity, I think, for us as members of the church, you know, today needs to feel like change needs to feel like continuity. I think for the majority of membership to feel like change is not an indictment of their past choices and their past behavior and past practices, but simply a continuing of revelation. It has to feel like continuity.
Yeah.
So how do you make change feel like continuity? I feel like the changes that I suggest in the book and the sort of this awakening to the potential for women's involvement and increased authority, I mean increased narrative, is absolutely crucial to laying the foundation for change to feel like continuity. That's how it's gonna. And so, you know, I'm less concerned with what this looks like 10 years, 50 years at the second coming, you know, than I am about getting us there as a body of Christ. Because Mormon feminism right now and Mormonism right now is incredibly diverse. We can't go off and choose our Reform, conservative, or Orthodox congregation. We can't even pick, you know, within our cities where we go and worship. And I think that's by design, and I think that is divine. And I think that, you know, we are somewhat unique in that, and I think it forces, you know, similar kinds of growth that we find when we're, you know, just plopped into families. It's a similar schooling. And moving that whole body of Christ means that you have to be aware of and sympathetic to those diverse bodies, those diverse congregations within the body. And so I think the most important thing – well, I think my point is that for me the priority is moving the body of Christ as a unified whole.
And you feel good that that'll happen? You sense that's where you're headed?
I hope so. I'm doing my best to make it happen. But you know, I think the diversity of Mormon feminism is a net positive. Certainly, it's opening up conversations that we weren't having even just a couple years ago. But again, you know, I would love to see those differing strains work together and continue to build on their diversity rather than let it drive them apart, so that you know, we prioritize a positive and a journey that builds us up as we move along it rather than tears us apart.
Nylan McBain, your book is called Women at Church: Magnifying LDS Women's Local Impact. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm guessing we jump-started a few conversations here. You can join the conversation by going on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.